This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hey, everybody, I'm Francesca Maxime, and welcome to this edition of the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. It is December 30th. It is the last podcast that I will be taping in 2020, and my, oh my, what a year it has been for all of us. And as we sort of begin to transition into the new year and a lot of the things that might be yet to emerge, things that perhaps we are hopeful about, things that are sort of incubating or generating, I wanted to turn our attention to something that is part of the podcast. We talk about trauma, we talk about mindfulness, we talk about the different kinds of neuroscience interviews that I've done, but also the creative arts, because that's a piece that because we've been paying so much attention to racial justice overtly and the ways in which we've really witnessed the Black Lives Matter movement and the uprising over the summer of 2020 and into, of course, the fall and the winter as everything is continuing to be in process. We're also sort of tapping into, well, what's new, what's fun, what's creative, what's joyful, and all the different ways in which creativity and emergence and being your truest self, being your most honest and authentic self is a contribution to the world and a celebration of joy that is your deepest birthright. And one of the ways in which I have been really experiencing joy is through the music of a Mr. Warren Wolf, a vibraphonist who I am so thrilled is here with us today. He's a multi-instrumentalist, actually, not just vibraphone, from Baltimore, Maryland. And from the young age of 3 years old, he's been trained on the vibraphone and the marimba, the drums, the piano as well. Under the guidance of his father, Warren Wolf Sr., Warren has a deep background in all genres of music, beginning, get this, with classical music. He studied composers like Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Paganini. Oh my goodness, I haven't heard some of these names in a long time. Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Duke Ellington in the jazz era, and Weather Report, Wynton Marsalis, and a lot more. He studied at Berkeley, the Peabody Preparatory School for 8 years. And I could go on and on about the folks that Warren has worked with and the kinds of albums that he's put out, including Christmas Vibes, which just came out in the winter of 2020. The song that you listen to when you hear the introduction to Rerooted is Warren's song. Warren wrote that. It's called Gang Gang. And I am thrilled that he's here with us tonight to celebrate joy in music and your creative spirit. Hi, Warren.
Hello, what's happening?
I can't believe this is like happening already because we just chatted and like, here you are. One of the things during this pandemic that has been so difficult for us all is we can't go anywhere or do anything. And one of the things that I loved is that these live stream concerts started popping up on my feeds for things like, all the places where I normally would go and listen to live music in New York because it's so rich. We have so many beautiful venues, whether it's Smalls or the Blue Note or the Village Vanguard or whomever it is, and we can go. And when I started to see that there were live stream concerts I was thrilled. And many of them that I have been enjoying lately have been from you, even in Baltimore, because I can listen to them from wherever. But I think the one I caught first this year was with Emmett Cohen at Emmett's Place. And so in any case, I just want to say thank you for brightening at least this girl's winter here in 2020, and keeping the spirit alive with your music.
No problem. It's been an honor to continue to play during this pandemic. It's very important for me to continue to play to give people some type of normalcy, to keep the music going. I know a lot of friends who have used this time in multiple ways to just take time off to relax. Other friends have said, I'm just not going to play because I'm nervous. Me, I've just kept going. I just said, okay, I might not be able to travel, like getting on an airplane or a train somewhere, but I'm just going to continue to make things happen for my hometown of Baltimore. And it's been an awesome, well, I can't say awesome, but it's been a really good year. 2020 has been still very productive and busy for me.
I love that. You almost caught yourself like, oh no, I can't say it's been a good year, but you can say that. I mean, not that you need permission from me, but I love hearing that it's been productive and joyful for you. Tell me what's been great about it for you.
Well, when everything first happened, back in March, I remember I was on the road. I was in Oakland, California with a wonderful vocalist named Cecile McLaurin-Salvant.
And yes, I've heard her.
Yeah. So we recently, last year, recorded this new piece that's coming out. It's called the Old Gress. I'll explain that another time. Well, you'll hear about it. And we were on tour. We had four nights out of a week. It's a big ensemble. And I remember the first night we were at University of California in Davis, California. We managed to get that performance. And by this time, you know, the pandemic wasn't really that big yet, but it was really like coming. Mm-hmm. So we were on stage in Oakland, California at the Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. And we were sound checking. The general manager of the band on stage and said, hey guys, I'm sorry, this show isn't happening tonight. We were like, wow. So from there, we had a show at Los Angeles at Walt Disney Hall, canceled. Stanford University, canceled. So I went home. You know, I just said, okay, it's time to go home. So I went home and I just started practicing. My mindset was more like, you know, this will last like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, easy breezy. We'll be back on the road soon. But, you know, slowly but surely, I just kept getting emails just like everybody else. Cancel, 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 cancel. So I started to think, I'm like, well, what can I do in the meantime? You know, if all of these things are canceled. And I'm really good friends with two guys here in Baltimore. One guy, his name is Henry Wong. He runs a venue here in Baltimore called Andy Music. Mm. And I've been playing there many times. I would say in my lifetime, I've had to at least perform there at least 80 times at least.
Yeah.
He was the very first person in Baltimore to start live stream shows from his venue. And I was the first artist. He said, nice. Well, you want to do something? I said, sure. And, you know, because actually my whole thing was to, I just wanted to, again, like I said in the beginning, I wanted to just go on camera and just play for people. Mm. And I wanted to do it in a particular venue because my wife said, she said, you know, nobody's coming over our house.
Yeah.
So I called Henry and that's when he said, well, Warren, let's just try to do it right. Let's make a live stream. So from Andy Music to, a brand new club that just started in Baltimore last year. It's the Keystone Corner Baltimore, which is founded by NEA jazz master Todd Barkin. So between the two venues, I've just been bouncing back and forth pretty much on a weekly basis for the past, well, since March almost.
Yeah.
During that time, I'll say 2 weeks after the shutdown happened here in Maryland, that's when I recorded the new CD, The Christmas Vibes.
Mm.
Which came out, had a slight personnel change because one person was kind of afraid to be around everybody. And also at this time, this is during the time when nobody was talking about wearing masks. It was more like everybody just keep their distance from each other.
Uh-huh.
But he just wasn't really comfortable. So, you know, I wound up playing on the Christmas Vibes record all piano parts because of this person couldn't he since he pulled out at the very last
oh
minute.
Wow
so I you're all keyboard
you're parts. Like Prince
I'm the utility guy you know, we made the record and then I started to think, you know, I think one person had called and said, hey, Warren, can you lay down some tracks for me? You know, I have a record that I'm working on. I would love to have you on it. And I didn't have any equipment. So, again, a bunch of musicians, not just me, we all started ordering equipment, recording equipment online.
Uh-huh.
I called this company called Sweetwater, and I just probably invested about $2,000 in some very, not cheap, but just good enough recording equipment.
Sure.
And so that's been keeping me busy right there. So between the two venues here in Baltimore, doing recordings or tracking for people at home where I won't have to go anywhere really, and also teaching. I'm a faculty member at Peabody Conservatory here in Baltimore, and I also teach part-time at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And those two, and you know, every now and then somebody will call and ask for lessons. I think I've been to New York twice since the pandemic. I had a couple of recording sessions there. So, you know, what turned out, what I thought was going to be like a very chill year, it was actually still steady. The only difference was I wasn't really traveling everywhere like how I planned on it.
Yeah, right, right.
I haven't been on a plane yet, but I've been busy. So
right, right. And you're and you know what, you just exude positivity and you just exude, like, I don't know, appreciation. Like there's just a sense of you and in you that I get and that I receive, even in your music too, of like gratitude and joy and appreciation. And it's not like fake and it's not like papered on. And I'm sure you have bad days just like everyone, but that there's something about the quality of your attitude that I don't know. Tell me if you know, has anyone else ever said that about you? And if so, you know, where might you think that comes from?
Yeah, a few people have said to me, they said, Warren, you're a very positive and happy person. You're always smiling. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times when I'm on stage, people always say to me, they said, Warren, you have a very nice smile. You should show it more.
Yeah.
When I play, I don't smile because I'm just like, you know, I'm trying to concentrate on
playing. Right.
But that could come from a number of things, like, you know, I'm a father of five.
I know.
But I mean, my older three are with my ex-wife, then I got divorced and I got remarried, so my younger two are home with me now, and they're a lot of fun. They're busy and moving a lot, but they're a lot of fun. And my wife, she's awesome. She's very supportive. She's a retired ballerina.
Wow.
And she's very big into health. So that part right there, like the health side, you know, that kind of keeps us going. Well, keep me going, but still keeps us going. You know, just trying to take care of the body, take care of your mind, make sure you're mentally correct. Also, again, just trying to keep music going, trying to just make people happy because I've talked to so many people who are just, they're down and they're bored. And I try to talk to them and just say, you know, I try to uplift people. I try to get on social media as much as I can and just post videos. Hey guys, check this out. You know, just see what I'm working on and see if this brings you some type of positivity, you know, some type of hope. You know, yeah, that's pretty much it. I try to just be cool and, you know.
Yeah, no. And I think you do it so beautifully. And I love how you do it in a way that is so unique to you. And one of the things, I mean, this is a podcast that primarily is about a podcast network, primarily about mindfulness and spiritual, you know, sort of exploration and ways in which we're sort of, you know, dealing with our relative world and our lives here is just, you know, people who have arthritis and people who have, you know, problem, like, you know, don't like a rainy day and, you know, just the basic stuff that we deal with every day, including the big stuff like the pandemic and like racism and things like that. But then like this whole bigger piece of like, you know, nature and the cosmos, and aren't we a part of that too? And where do we fit in and all of that? And one of the things that we talk about with mindfulness practices or any Buddhist practice or any kind of practice really is that it's sort of often both something that's deeply profound and insightful at a certain point in time, like a big bang, like at a big aha moment that someone can have, or it can also be that cultivation of like, okay, now we're learning the Mixolydian scales. Now we're learning the, you know, the arpeggios. Now we're learning the, you know, and it's just sort of like, okay, we're gradually climbing. We're gradually putting one foot in front of the other, and that it's a practice. And so I see a lot of parallels with musicians like yourself and mindfulness and just sort of spiritual practices. And I don't know if that's something that you've ever thought about, or if you see yourself as a spiritual person, or if your musicianship, is it all part of a spiritual life that you have, or would you categorize it that way at all, or somehow differently?
I've never really thought about that, but if I had to really think it, maybe it is a tad bit spiritual. You know, some of the music that I may create, that I compose, it definitely has some type of spirituality in it. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I kind of just write from the heart.
Well, that is what I guess I'm saying, is that I think that there's a beautiful piece there, writing from the heart. When you're writing from the heart, are you feeling as though perhaps you're inspired and something is coming through you and moving through you, and then from that you then put it on the page?
Definitely. So the majority of my compositions, again, they come from the heart, but they're, at least nowadays, these days, I'm writing for people or a particular event or something that has happened. You know, a number of my songs are based on that. Like, for instance, the tune Gang Gang.
Mm-hmm. The one for the podcast.
That's right. So should I talk about that one?
Yeah, please do. I mean, it's a 7-minute song. I could play it in the middle of the podcast, but it's a long one.
Yeah, well, it's long. Well, it's long because of solos as well. But the whole backdrop, the background of the story. So my wife, again, like I said, she's a retired classical ballerina. Mm. So we were sitting down. This was, had to be about 5 years ago. Not that we have not seen this movie, but we were watching Coming to America.
Yes. Oh, God. God, that was, yeah, that's a classic.
That's right. And part two is coming out soon. But
nice.
Yeah. So we were watching Coming to America. And, you know, for those who have seen the movie and those who have not seen the movie, Eddie Murphy's character, Akeem, was about to get married. And, you know, right before, well, not the marriage part, like when he first met his bride. Anyway, they had this strong, like, tribal dance scene going on, kind of like an African rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one, two, ba, 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 you know, whatever. And my wife, we were watching that. She said, look at all that gang gang. And I looked at her, I said, what are you talking about? She said, you know, that style of dancing, we in the classical world, we don't do that. I started thinking, I said, okay, let me see, or I'm going to come up with a song. Like right there, that was already my story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to come up with a song that merges the two together. So when you're hearing the beginning of the song, you hear this strong, like 6-8 clave rhythm. But right in the middle of the song, we segue over to this classical sound. You know, I'm thinking Bach, Beethoven. And again, all of that stuff is just a part of my background. So I just put the two styles together. And the song is basically a composition for my wife. So I titled it Gang Gang.
I so love that. I want to hear it now. I want to play like half of it. And then I want to pause. And then I want you to talk a little bit about it. And then I'm going to play the other half. And then we're going to come back and talk some more. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, let's hold on 1 second. All right, this is Gang Gang by Warren Wolf. Thank you. We're going to pause right here. All right, now we're picking it up again with the conversation. We're just pausing right there because we're shifting from the gang gang piece to more the classical piece.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And tell me what it's like to have trained in this classical world and then be sort of in a pop world in many ways, a jazz pop world.
You know, growing up, I honestly thought that I was going to be a classical musician. I was like really good at playing classical music. I was in this group, I remember, at Peabody called the Peabody Sinfonia. And they actually gave me one of my first couple of tours. And I was the lead percussion, well, the lead timpanist. I played timpani in this group. I remember we had a 2-week tour of London, and I know we had another 2-week tour of Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. So actually, my first tours in life were all classical. So I had those two. And then when I was a kid, I went on tour with the Baltimore Symphony with playing this piece called the Pied Piper Fantasy with Flounder James Galway. So my classical upbringing was awesome. I think, the thing that I love about classical music, it gives you such a command of your instrument. It teaches you how to read really well, to play with technique, control, facility, all those good things.
Yeah.
Everything that I learned from classical music, I just switched it over to jazz.
Well, you know what I love about this is as you're speaking and I'm hearing you say that again, with the context of the way that this podcast is, we're talking about things like mindfulness practices. And there's a thing called concentration practice, which is more of a discipline practice where you use something called like virya energy, more around the idea of like, no, I'm really just going to keep sticking with this thing that I need to do, because even though it's not like my most fun favorite thing out there, it helps me get to a place of what you just said, which I think you called it, I don't know, you said foundational. What was the word that you used?
Facility?
A facility, like, yeah, that there's a foundational facility that you get, a mastery, if you will, if you can, and you know, work from that classical base and then incorporate the jazz, which is more what we might consider something like open awareness practice or something, or the being in the moment kind of a thing. Because when you're doing your improvisations in those jazz, you know, songs, I mean, I think there's something else at work there besides just you, but you needed the mastery to get there.
Definitely. You know, one thing my dad said, in any skill in life, whatever you choose to do, he always said that you need 15,000 hours worth of practice.
He added 5 because they said 10.
10,000. Oh, well, he definitely gave me 15,000.
I love it. Tell me more.
So I started playing at the young age of 3. And since we're talking about, you know, having that mind, you know, to master things, mm-hmm. You know, I look at my own children, I'm just like, wow. And, you know, my daughter is 4, my youngest child. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't even imagine keeping my daughter in the basement. I mean, our basement was cool, but, you know, I can't imagine telling my daughter to come down here in the basement for 90 minutes to hold your concentration to perform well on 3 different instruments.
Wow.
Which is what my father did for me, or to me.
Wow.
Either you want to put it at 2 or 4 me at the age of 3. 30 minutes on mallets, instruments, labobs, marimba, another 30 minutes on the keyboards, and another 30 minutes on drums. That lasted 5 days per week until the age, well, from the age of 3 up until 17.
Wow.
Summer times it doubled because I grew up in a crazy neighborhood. And then also Saturdays, I was taking lessons at Peabody Preparatory. So again, 6 days of training from the age of 3 up until 17. That's a lot of hours.
That's a lot of hours. I mean, you know, that would be like the equivalent of, you know, they pick the Dalai Lama and they sort of, you're the one, you know,
yeah.
And I mean, there's training, there's deep, deep, deep training there. Right. And, mm-hmm. and you pretty much had, your basement was the monastery in a way, you know what I mean? Like when you're with a lot of these folks, they'll go and study with a teacher somewhere, or an abbot or whatnot in, you know, India or Tibet or something, and they'll practice for 12, 14, 16 hours a day. And it sounds like that, you know, was your basement was that, and your dad was your teacher.
Yeah, it was like our sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And tell me, you just said I had a crazy neighborhood. You know, this is what my dad and I did together. This is what he made me do or did to me or did for me. Which one was it? Did you have a feeling of it being done to you, or was it really done for you or with you?
Overall, it was done for me. As a young child, I'm thinking you're doing something to me, because again, the neighborhood was crazy. I've seen a lot of stuff coming up in the living in the inner, you know, the inner city. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize until I got older, okay, my dad is just trying to keep me on a guided path, a path to success, when a lot of my friends that I grew up with, they didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
I have two older sisters. They were cool. But, you know, it's just the other people in my neighborhood, they... I mean, don't get me wrong. I went out and hung with those guys too. But my dad gave me a career path.
I mean, right.
I'm not thinking of another word, but he gave me a career path at an early age. So at a young age, you know, I'm thinking this is like punishment. Why are you keeping me down here every day for 90 minutes to practice? I'd rather be playing with toys outside with my friends all the time. And I did that, but it was just, okay, there's a certain time where we're going to practice. And my dad, he was very militant because he was a Vietnam veteran.
Mm.
So, you know, I had no choice but to do it. But eventually, you know, once you started doing something, you become good at it. And I started to really enjoy it. I think around the time when I was 11 or 12, that's when I was like, okay, let's do it for real.
Yeah, let's do it for real. I'm just loving learning more about this, because I think there is something to that discipline that is not particularly fun or choiceful. But when you kind of get it down to a certain point and you have a certain sense of mastery, then like when you were 12 in your case, then the fun can begin, because then you can see what all of it was for, right? Yeah. It's like, now I'm flexible. I can be Gumby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a stick figure anymore.
Definitely. No, just very fun times coming up, you know. Once I hit 12 and beyond, you know, it was just soaking up influence from everybody as much as I can.
Like other musicians that you're working with or teaching are teaching with you, influence from whom?
Other teachers. I mean, my dad was a history teacher. He was not a professional musician. He taught United States and world history in schools.
Wow.
He loved playing. But, you know, from him, again, classmates, just listening to recordings, listening to music, and everything wasn't just based around jazz, you know, just listening to just popular music. Even with my two older sisters, I used to listen to the things that they would play around the house.
Like what?
For me, I guess my ear started developing in the 80s. So, I mean, I was born in 79. So early hip hop, like, you know, Run DMC, In Vogue, Beastie Boys, all of that stuff. From, I remember they used to watch this movie, this hip hop movie called Crush Groove. And I used to, you know, I was kind of young because, I mean, I love my sisters, but they exposed me to a lot of stuff at a young age. You know, I was like, wait, what did he just say?
Right, so, right.
But, you know, it's cool. I knew what was right and what was wrong. But, you know, all of that type of stuff. Again, I mean, pretty much all everything that my sisters and my parents played around the house is what got me going.
I love that. You know, you mentioned your dad was a Vietnam vet and that you grew up in, and you still live in Baltimore area, but that you grew up in what did you call it? An inner city neighborhood?
Just to be frank, I grew up in the hood.
You grew up in the hood. Okay. So growing up, I mean, where I'm assuming you're saying I saw a lot of things. I saw, you know, violence or,
yeah,
you know.
Violence. I mean, even though, I mean, nothing compared to today, really. I mean, it's still bad. Violence is violence. But I've seen, the reason I remember we moved from this particular neighborhood, because I think we lived there from 1980 up until 91. I'll never forget when I saw a dead body across the street from our house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, stuff like that. Again, my parents didn't explain to me how traumatic that would be. Not that it did anything to me, but that's just an image you don't forget.
Right. And how old were you?
10.
Wow.
Yeah. Just to see a lifeless body. And then when the police come and when they have to clean the street with the, you know, with the water, the hose.
Right.
And when they, I think the drain was kind of like on the end of our house. So when they're trying to clean the sidewalk and you see blood going, I'm just, you know, stuff like that. You don't forget it. I never forget that. And then of course they had like neighborhood gangs, all around who would battle from other, you know, neighborhoods. You know, I've seen all of that, every bit of it. And then one of the reasons, one of the reasons, why I was telling you why my dad decided to keep me on that straight path, because in my family, at least for the, not all, but a good part of the men in my family were up to no good. I love them to death, but they were...
they were kind of rascals.
Yeah, they're not good, you know. I mean, they're good people, but they're just, you know...
up to no good.
Yeah, they're up to no good. Mm-hmm. My dad, he just made sure to keep me away from that.
Right. I understand.
I grew up in a two-parent home. A lot of the men in my family, at least my cousins, at least, they grew up in a single-parent home. And to the point where their moms couldn't really control them. So, you know, I had my mother and my father and my two sisters always, they were on me because I'm the baby. And they could see, okay, he's going to be something special in school.
Yeah.
You know, from the principal saying, they were like, wow, you know, Warren, he can play. You know, everybody. So they was like, we're going to make sure you're good. You know, you're very well protected.
Beautiful. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I love that because, like you said, you know, as a kid, you would have just played, I don't know, jacks or checkers or do whatever kids do all day, but that you took the discipline as love and that you really saw what the alternative could be, mm-hmm. even though it was a shock to the system. And again, I work with trauma, folks who have had trauma, vicarious trauma, people who are traumatized, racialized trauma, obviously, all of that, physical, emotional. And I'm wondering, what were your reflections this summer about the uprising and the way in which that, you know, the pandemic coincided with everything with Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and how that's just highlighting what has been obviously the core wound, I think, of this country since its quote unquote founding, which of course is its own story in terms of indigenous genocide.
I think the whole thing is troubling. I think the country really needs to come together. I mean, Baltimore, we were right in the middle of a racial uprising, I would say like maybe 4 years ago when we had the murder of Freddie Gray.
Right.
And that happened here in Baltimore. And I watched, it wasn't the entire city. A lot of people thought it was the entire city. It was a few blocks in like the most inner African-American neighborhood in Baltimore where, you know, looting, stores on fire and things like that. People were battling the police. I think all of it is pretty sad. I think it's unfortunate that a lot of African Americans I can't necessarily say, I mean, my honest feelings, I can't say we're being targeted because I know this stuff can happen to anybody, but I know it's been happening to a lot of African Americans. And that's kind of troubling. A lot of people say, you know, it's because of Trump, you know, that people feel that they can come out and just be who they really are. You know, they could never be, you know, come out. But they said, actually, the correct thing, Trump has made it okay to show that you're racist. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I got to be totally honest with you. I really don't get into a lot of conversations about this too much, at least with other friends. But, you know, because a lot of friends, they be like, well, this and that. And I'm just like, listen, I don't want to hear it. But it's kind of sad, you know, up until recently, you know, just like the thing that's just happened over a few days ago, my friend Keon Harrell. You heard about that?
Yeah, no.
Oh, yeah. So this went viral. Keon is a wonderful trumpeter.
Yes. Oh, with the phone.
Yes. He's a really good friend of many people. I mean, he's very well.
I mean, his son's phone.
Yeah. He's very well liked in the jazz community, but he's been out with many people from, I mean, in jazz, Robert Glasper, Common, the hip hop artist, Esperanza Spalding, you know, many people. And, you know, now this has happened with his son.
Just for those listeners and viewers who haven't been familiar with it, Keon Harrell was in a hotel that apparently a woman was not checked in at, but had stayed at, from what I understand, and was convinced that his son's phone was her phone. But it was that the security guard or the manager at the hotel was aligning with her in terms of her affirmation that it was her phone that his son was holding, which was his phone. And it just sort of showed what it means to sort of have, and mind you, this is a racial context, right? She's white, he's black.
He's only 14 at that too.
I'm sorry?
The son is only 14 years old as well.
Yeah, he's a kid.
Yeah.
He's a kid. And she grabbed him and tackled him and took the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that the person who was at the hotel seemed to, in the video, and you can see the video on Instagram, you know, to not be listening to anything that your friend had to say about it. And that's really troubling, because what it points to is what we've sort of tried to talk about in this podcast and in other, you know, trainings that I've done, which is the more implicit biases and the ways in which, you know, we get locked up and caught up in the way that systemic oppression over time plays out in these, what some might call microaggressions, others might call macroaggressions, but nonetheless, violations of your own space, your own dignity.
Yeah. It's quite sad. I mean, a lot of this stuff happens. I mean, My oldest son, who was 17, after talking with his mother in Boston, you know, he was racially profiled at a skating rink. He's one of the better skaters. Like, this boy can skate his butt off. Mm-hmm. His tricks and everything. But the manager of the skating rink refused to let him in because he's kind of better than anybody, so she banned him from the skating rink. I'm just like, what was that about, you know?
So, wow. Wow. And this is the lived experience. And meanwhile, I mean, you're here as this amazing composer and you're here as this, and so is he, right? And, you know, and that in those kinds of situations, the underlying reaction or the underlying has nothing to do with you as a human, as an individual, as a person. It has to do with a racial profiling, which is about some blanket idea that someone may have about what a stereotype, a profile, or whatever, that has nothing to do with anything about curiosity, about, you know, an invitation of, well, who is this person? You know, what's happening here? And everything to do with assumption, which is the whole point that mindfulness tries to teach, is can we drop our assumptions and can we get curious? And can we just be in the moment and just like meet you where you're at?
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
You want to listen to the rest of Gang Gang?
Sure.
All right, hold on. We're going to do the classical part now. And we're going to play out Gang Gang. Thank you. All right. What was happening there? We had the classical interlude.
Yep. So right when we stopped right there, that was the beginning of the solo section. But there was that one section that we heard. It was just really lush and classical. You heard a lot of motifs from if you listen from the piano. You don't really hear a lot of jazz improvisation that's going on between myself or the saxophonist, who is Steve Wilson on this recording.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the studio with the guys, I just asked them, the piano player had a specific part that he had to play. As far as myself and Steve, I asked him, I said, just play counterpoint with me, which is, just basic interplay between us. Carl Allen, the drummer, I asked him to just play a lot of cymbals and sounds and splashes. And Christian McBride on bass, the leader of the session, he's just kind of pulsing on one particular note.
Mm-hmm. All right. You want to keep it going?
Yeah, sure.
All right. I couldn't help myself. I just could not. I mean, that's some good stuff right there. And you have to work out to get those wrists and hands and arms so strong, don't you, to make it so gentle and elegant?
Yeah, you do. And I do quite a bit of that.
I mean, it's a discipline. I guess what I'm trying to really get across here is that all that joy and beauty comes through and out of your practice, your discipline practice and your attention to detail. It doesn't just come from nowhere. So that, I play tennis. I used to try to play fake book jazz on the piano, but I kind of wasn't as good as you were with that. But I mean, nor am I really that great on the tennis court, but I watch Roger Federer, and I love watching him play. And there was a New York Times article written about him maybe 5 or 10 years ago that said he's like a ballerina, to your wife's point, on the tennis court, because he's so fluid and effortless. And to listen to you, it's like syrup, it's like sweet and it's like light and it's like airy, and that just doesn't come from nowhere.
For me, it all again is rooted in that classical tradition. I just try to flow. I try to play like there's a combination of a violin player or a flautist mixed in with Charlie Parker. I think Charlie Parker is one of the greatest masters ever on this horn. But then again, I just try to take what he's done and mix it with everything else. My thing is all about mixing. There's a time and place for everything. If we want to play pop music, if we want to play classical, if you want to play something that's crazy out of this world, if you want to play something that's traditional jazz, or if we need a song that just shows that has a showcase of all multiple styles combined, I just try to mix everything and just try to play the right note. My thing, what I like to describe myself as, I'm actually like, I like to look at myself now as a musical healer.
A musical healer. I love that.
Musical healer. Definition of a musical healer. So we have many people who go to work. They work a regular 9-to-5 job. And then when they come home, they want to release from the day. Stressful, non-stressful, whatever. They just want to take their mind off of what happened during the day. So they want to come hear some music. Our jobs as musicians are to entertain them, take their minds away from that. Mm. Me personally, my message to anybody who comes to see my show or purchase any of my music is for you to get a sense of relief and comfort from hearing what I have to say to you.
Beautiful.
And I look at myself, yes, I know I'm a musician, but I'm more of a healer. I just want to make people feel good. You know, it's funny, some of the record company, whenever I come up with a new record, they always ask that question. So what's the concept? I was like, make people feel good.
Yeah, I love that.
It's going to have a slight, okay, it's based on this, but at the same time, every song is built to make you feel good.
And you do that. And it's so interesting to hear you call yourself that, because that's what I feel on the other side of it. It's not, I can't not feel joyful when I'm hearing you play or watching you play or even speaking with you now. And so that idea of healing, that idea of offering that idea of, again, it's a mindfulness principle of generosity, is a really, that you have a generous spirit and a generous heart. And you said the music comes from the heart and comes through you, but comes through all your practice. And so I think I just want to like highlight that before we get to the live version of the song that you wrote for your mom that I want you to introduce to before we kind of close out our time together today, which is just that, you know, these principles of spiritual principles or mindfulness principles or Buddhist principles or any principles rooted in ethics and discipline, because it's not just about mindfulness. It's about the integration of, if we can establish a baseline of, you know, what you called the, I keep losing the word from the classical.
What's that?
Basically the mastery that you get from just being able to do what you need to do and learn what you need to learn from the classical music, the concentration that you get from that enables you to then be in a place where you can be more improvisational and free and then be more generous. And I think it's the same quality that we find in a lot of, at least I found in a lot of really deep spiritual teachers, where in their presence, you just feel space.
Yeah.
You just feel cared for, loved, unjudged, perhaps, and that there's room for allowing. And I think that the way in which you've cultivated all of your musicality and your discipline makes space for that and does really have these beautiful, generous offerings for others. So I just want to say thank you.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's I love that, a musical healer, because there are healers in every form. And I would invite any of our listeners or viewers to just see if we can view our lives as art, as living art, view our lives in the way that we treat others as a discipline, and as a generosity of spirit and generosity of heart. So you have your song that you wrote for your mother. So maybe we'll close out on that, and you're going to play it for us live.
Yeah. So just a quick introduction. The name of this tune is called Simply For Ma. This is off of my record, Reincarnation, that came out in January of this year. And I lost my mother about 4 years ago. And she retired early from her job. Mm. And she was trying to figure out, like, well, now I'm retired, what am I going to do? So my dad figured, he's like, well, let me just start giving her keyboard lessons, which is something that she always wanted. So for about two or three years, right up until our death, they would sit at my dad's studio and just play all of these songs, like from the Motown era. Mm. And she would play them on piano, not the melody, but she would just play like the chords. And my mom got really good playing piano within 2 years. I mean, far better than what I did. And I can honestly say that.
That's amazing.
So when she passed, I remember I wrote this song that same week, because that same week I had a show at Jazz at Lincoln Center. And my band members, they said, Warren, are you going to still make the show? And I thought about it and I said, yeah, I'm going to do it. You know, my mom will want me to do it. So I remember that same night when she passed away, I sat at the keyboard and I was just sitting down crying and I was playing piano and this melody came up and I just kind of sat up and I wiped the tears. I said, wow, this sounds kind of cool. Something upbeat. Instead of writing something all sad and gloomy, I'm going to write something that she liked to do. So this song, again, for Ma, it's kind of like you'll hear like a tambourine going. It brings back that whole Motown feel. It's mm-hmm. just basically a tribute of something that she likes, something that's very upbeat, very happy. And yeah, if she were alive, she would definitely love it. I could see her now. She'd be like, boy, this sounds great. Exactly how she would talk to me if she heard it. So,
well, I love that. So let's dedicate this for Ma, to her, and to everyone who's lost anyone really in 2020. It's been a challenging year for everyone, and to the honor and the spirit of your mom, the joyful Motown spirit. This is Mr. Warren Wolf. You can find out much more about him, his beautiful story, his beautiful music at his website, warrenwolfmusic.com. And again, my most sincere gratitude on behalf of myself and the Be Here Now group for graciously allowing us to use Gang Gang as the music for Rerooted, because it is much loved. So I'll let you get set up for that. Thank you so much, Warren.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Warren Wolf, everybody on the vibes with Hey Ma. And thank you for that performance. We love it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's amazing. Thank you for joining us on Rerooted, and we will check you out. WarrenWolf.com, everybody. Happy 2021.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.